You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Are there any myths that you'd like to test but can't?
Well, we did a whole episode on busting the conspiracy theory that the moon landing was faked. Mm-hmm. And there are some people who are still unconvinced. So we would love to, if time, money were no object, build a spaceship, go to the moon, and come back with a piece of Apollo hardware.
Oh, that would be cool.
All in one take.
That would be cool. That would be cool. Well, can't you get a telescope strong enough to see the Apollo stuff on the moon?
We researched it, and no. Not even the Hubble can resolve the images of the moon to tight enough resolution to see actual, like, footprints or pieces of Apollo hardware.
Would you be open to the idea that it didn't happen? Or do you want to prove it? See?
No.
What would I... See? See?
In this, I have to admit to some bias that we've already been there. I believe absolutely, unequivocally, that of course we went there.
Well,
so.
Then you're unqualified to have the tests. How do I know you're not going to bring a piece of equipment up there? I can't trust you now. You're like evolutionary scientists. They'll do anything to prove that it's real.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
What would prove to you beyond this, because I'll be honest, I'm skeptical you're going to be able to raise $100 million. And if you did, why the hell wouldn't you just leave, dude, and just go get a nice place, like in the Bahamas or something, and forget about all this moon crap? Because then you have $100 million.
Nah, that's not my style. In fact, I've made a promise that every time someone sends in a donation, I acknowledge, you know, to prove that I'm not using it for personal luxuries or anything like that. Every time someone sends in a donation, no matter how small or how big or whatever, you know, I acknowledge it in my video and, you know, basically keep viewers informed just to prove that the money stays where it is.
Okay.
You know, I get the $200 million.
I was just making a joke.
Okay, well, as Desmond Llewellyn would say, I never joke about my work.
There you go. All right. I like that attitude. But beyond just because, you know, it is an awful lot of money, what would prove what could you do here on Earth to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that we didn't go to the moon? You run up against the old argument of trying to prove a negative. So how do you do that? Is it even possible?
Well, there is one way to settle the argument completely once and for all, and that is, okay, we have these telescopes in Chile. As I said, they've got the Very Large Telescope, and it's basically these four large optical telescopes daisy chained together. Okay, and so basically you can look at the moon and you can see objects on the resolution of 1 milliarcsecond. Okay, now you need a resolution of about 2 milliarcsecond to see artifacts on the moon that small. You know, so this thing has a perfect capable resolution to resolve the man-made equipment on the surface. So if you went to this facility and pointed it at the Apollo landing site, you'd be able to see whether or not there's anything up there. You know, and Bill Casing, he had constantly said that he would accept that as proof that whether or not the moon missions were real. He says, if there's a lunar lander there, I'll recant on that, and I'll retract my claims, apologize to the astronauts, you know, both apology and stuff. But if there's nothing up there, then, as he said, I'll rest my case. You know, and as the grandson, I feel it is my duty to hold on behalf of him him to that, you know. So he's passed away now, but if we can get the telescope, look at the moon and see if there's anything up there, then on his behalf and on behalf of myself and all the other moon hoax conspiracy theorists, okay, I'll make a public apology to the Apollo astronauts, you know, hey guys, sorry, but you know, I was wrong, and you know, congratulations on your trip. But if it turns out that we look through this thing and there's nothing up there, okay, then I say, ha ha, I told you there's nothing up there, but did you listen to me? Oh, no, you know, didn't you? You know, it's fake. You know, and there's your proof. It's quite interesting too, is that I think the guy's name was David West, one of the guys who was working on this thing. He said that they would try to image the landing sites, and so far, as far as I can tell, there has been no word on whether or not they've been able to find this thing. As far as I can tell, they haven't released any pictures showing the lunar module. Even though they've got this resolution, they haven't seemed to have found the lunar module yet.
Well, it's interesting that you made that statement about, you know, you'd accept it if you saw the image, because and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I'm about 95% sure that I sort of put that argument forward to Bart Sabrell when we had him on the show. Regarding, well, you know, if you could get an image of the landing site and all the artifacts from, you know, a telescope, wouldn't that prove it? And he said, you know, if they went so far as to fake the moon landing, wouldn't they just fake the images then and send them out you know, and say, hey, we just got it. We just imaged it off the moon here from this thing in Chile, and here it is. And you really, it's just something they created on a computer. I mean, aren't you setting yourself up there to be hoodwinked, if you will, provided you're obviously, you know, provided you're correct about the moon hoax?
I saw your interview with Bart Sobrell a few years back. I haven't seen him in a long while, but I don't recall him saying anything. I'll take your word for it, though. But
yeah. Well, I mean, beyond the, you know, I'm pretty sure about that. But let's just go beyond that and just say, let's just take it, the argument that I presented there, and just use it as from there. You know, wouldn't you be setting yourself up to be hoodwinked, you know, by the original moon hoaxers, if you will? Wouldn't they just hoax the proof, if you will?
It all comes down to personal opinion as to what you feel is the absolute proof, I guess. But the benefit of an optical telescope is that you can look at it in real time. You're looking at it yourself. It's not some image from a NASA-owned space probe that is encrypted and sent back to Earth to NASA facilities and stuff. You know, this is something that you're standing there. You've got the eyepiece. Well, nowadays we use monitors and stuff, you know, but you're looking directly at this in real time, you know, with this telescope. You can position it every way you want, whichever way you want to go to and stuff, and so you're looking at it there. You know, that would be direct first-hand and proof to anyone, I guess. So that's my stance along those lines, and that's why I would accept a view through an optical telescope. I'm not familiar with I don't recall what Sobrell, I haven't seen you at the radio show that he was on in a while back, but I don't recall what he said along those lines. But like I said, it all comes down to personal opinion, I guess. And whatever's good enough for the grandfather, I'm sure it should be good enough for everyone else within the moon hoax movement.
That's true, but knowing the paranormal community and the conspiracy community as I do, I know that nothing is really good enough in a way, you know, because it's just always elusive. It's like, again, trying to prove that negative is just so difficult.
Well, you tend to get people like that on the propaganda side of things, because one of the big propagandists, Jay Windley, he publicly said that even if Neil Armstrong admitted that it was a hoax, he still wouldn't believe it. And in fact, they even had a little opinion. Yeah, they had an opinion poll as well. You know, basically, you know, asking people, okay, what would convince you that the moon missions are fake? And the vast majority of them said that nothing would convince them. So you've got these propagandists who have already made up their mind that no matter what happens, no matter what you say, nothing is going to sway them. They're going to be propagating this myth all their life. Okay, even if I go up there and die, they'll probably just say, oh, his was an exception. They had a major flare there, whereas the others didn't. Well, the Apollo missions, they also had major flares and stuff. But you know, they just come with one bullshit excuse after another. And so, no matter what you got your different, there's different categories of believers. You've got people who are open to both sides of the thing, and you know, who can be swayed, you know, can be turned and stuff. But then you've got your die-hard propagandists who would not believe that the missions were faked, even if the astronauts made a deathbed confession or publicly stated that. And one of the games that they love playing is alleging that everyone who's a scientist believes that the Apollo missions are real. You never find a credentialed expert who believes that the Apollo missions are fake. Well, the fact is, some of the conspiracy theorists do in fact have credentials. Like one of them was Bill Wood, who has a BSc, and one of them was Dr. David Groves, obviously has a PhD and stuff, and the astronaut Brian O'Leary, even though he believes that, even though he says, I think they did land, he says, I'm not 100% sure, you know. And so then you've got, there's this other guy, Dr. Q Zeng, even though he doesn't believe, even though he never really commented on the moon missions, he has expressed doubt of the recent, Chinese spacewalk. He said that they were filmed in a swimming pool, you know. So then you got people who do have credentials who actually doubt the moon missions or certain other space missions and stuff. And so, but when you present them with this, they either say, oh, their credentials are phony, or if it's beyond a shadow of a doubt that the credentials are legit, you know, they just say, he's wrong, I don't care, you know, the vast, you know, it just seems almost like a popularity contest now. You know, it's no longer about evidence, now it all seems to be about popularity.
Yeah.
So that's what they've basically turned this into now.
Now, another aspect of this whole thing that I wanted to talk to you about is sort of these two tangential conspiracies that are sort of lumped in with the moon hoax theory, and that is the Apollo 1 disaster, I guess you could say, or tragedy, and the Challenger disaster slash tragedy. And a lot of people in the moon hoax community think that both of these were orchestrated events. So I know that Bill Kasing did, and since you're the grandson of the moon hoax theory, I figure you know at least about these ideas, and maybe you can weigh in on where you stand as far as believing in these two sort of peripheral conspiracies.
Yeah, I actually produced a video on this. It's called Moonfaker Apollo 1. It can be viewed on YouTube. It's also available on this data DVD that's released by moonmovie.com. You know, it's featured on there along with the Apollo 1 investigation report. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the astronaut Gus Grissom, he was known to be very, very outspoken about the Apollo project. He constantly said that he didn't feel it would work, that someone would die from the, you know, on their mission. They felt that, if I recall correctly, he said there was only like a 1 in 3 chance of it actually, of this actually being successful. And he to let the world know what he thought of the Apollo program, he took a lemon off his tree and hung it on the Apollo command module. And, you know, basically, I believe the Americans refer to non-roadworthy cars as lemons. So Basically, that was what he thought of his spaceship. You know, basically, the idea was Apollo 1 was supposed to be an Earth orbit flight, and if it was successful, he would be slated to be the first man to walk on the moon. You know, because he was basically their poster boy for astronauts. You know, and so he was their number one choice. And so, but basically, he was very outspoken with this. He didn't feel it was going to work. And NASA, evidently, it became clear that he would not go along when it was his time to fake the first moonwalk. You know, and so they needed to silence him, and they also needed to send a message out to all the astronauts who would follow in his footsteps. And so on January 27th, right, during a plugs out test, he was loaded into this capsule along with his crew, the Apollo 1 capsule. Now, if you understand what we're sitting in right now, what the air you're breathing is nitrogen and oxygen at 14.7 psi, that's pounds per square inch. Now, in space, the Apollo capsule would have an interior pressure of about 5 psi pure oxygen, okay, and if you wanted to simulate this on the ground, right, you would need to pump the air pressure up to about 20 psi. All this in pure oxygen, but you know, normally, right? They do the oxygen tests and the plugs out tests separately. Today they decided to do it at the same time. They put the astronauts in there and pump up the pressure. But if that's not enough, right? There's so many other issues that NASA, they just seem to go out of their way to make the capsule as unsafe as possible. There was like 5 miles of wiring in their thing, all really bad. In fact, John Young, one of the Apollo astronauts, he has made statements on TV and stuff like that, saying that their wires are really bad. He says, "Oh, I constantly told Grissom to speak out about them," and he says, "If I do, they'll fire me." Yeah, well, evidently they fired him quite literally. And if he was so concerned about the wires, then why didn't he speak out? And now then, there's also a thing called Velcro, which is, you know, that you use to stick things together and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And normally Velcro isn't a fire hazard, but if you put it in pure oxygen, it burns like a bitch.
Really?
So basically, in pure oxygen, even stainless steel will burn. Okay, including asbestos. Right, NASA had 4 tests, you know, at various Air Force bases, at Brooks Air Force Base and Johnsville Navy Air Station and various other places. Right. In which men were burned critically in these pure oxygen chamber tests. And that one of them, right, their guy was simply changing a light bulb, right? And what happened is that the spark happened and it set his arm on fire, set his clothes on fire, right? Some guy comes over with an asbestos fire blanket. You know, normally they use asbestos as fireproofing and stuff. They wraps his arm in it and the asbestos blanket caught up on fire.
Oh, boy.
This was in 1962, right? And NASA subsequently filed reports on this, you know, that say these tests illustrate in concrete fashion the potential dangers of pure oxygen atmospheres, right? And so yet in NASA, they classified this test as not hazardous, and so they had all this confirmable stuff inside there, such as Velcro, and in fact Grissom, he was constantly complaining about that there was too much Velcro, too much flammable shit in the capsule, right? He complained that to, he mentioned that to Joe Shea during the acceptance test, which was in like October or August or something the year before that. He was saying that there was too much Velcro and stuff like that, you know, and the rule was that nothing that can react to a spark should be within 4 or 10 inches within any ignition source, you know, like wires or whatever, but the whole interior was just plastered with it, you know. They covered the entire capsule interior with Velcro. Joe Shea, you know, he says that he ordered. Joe Shea was the systems manager, and basically he says, oh, I got annoyed, and I said, look, we go clean up the capsule, you know, tells that to North American Aviation, and so, yet they never removed it, right? And interestingly enough, Joe Shea, he was actually giving an interview just before he died, in which he says that that Grissom was constantly complaining about this Velcro that's in there, and then he says Grissom put it in there himself. The astronauts, all three astronauts, they just plastered the Velcro wherever they wanted, as he said. Well, if he was so concerned about Velcro being a fire hazard, why would he put Velcro in the capsule in the first place?
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
It's like being concerned about petrol setting your car on fire and then dousing it with petrol. You know, it doesn't make any sense. It's basically blame the dead guy so you can save yourself. You know, not only did NASA know about the hazard, not only did they make it so dangerous, North American Aviation, their contractor, see, there's two groups of people, right? You've got NASA who's actually trying to launch this thing, and you've got North American Aviation who are basically building the capsule. You know, so you've got North American Aviation guys and NASA guys on the pad, you know, and since the 1960s, since the Mercury days, they had known that pure oxygen was going to be a hazard, you know. In fact, one of the guys, I believe his name was Frank Hendel, he submitted an article in the Journal of Aviation and Spaceflight, and he said that pure oxygen presents a fire hazard, which is especially great on the launching pad when the cabin is purged with oxygen at sea level pressure, right? And yet the guys from North American Aviation, you know, Harrison Storms, Charlie Feltz and Toby Friedman and stuff, they all claimed that they thought NASA was going to be doing the test at only 5 PSI. And they said, oh, had we known, we would have called them up and say, hey, hold everything, that's a hazard. We didn't know. We didn't know that they were going to be doing it. But one of their guys back in the 1960s explicitly stated that since the Mercury days, the pure oxygen is going to be hazardous, that it's a fire hazard. You know, he just said it right there, that they knew that they do this stuff at sea level pressure, in Apollo 1's case, 20 PSI, which is above sea level pressure, okay? And now they say we thought they were going to be doing it at only 5 PSI, which that's an outright lie to it there, you know? And so it doesn't make any sense. Oh, yeah, and about I just remembered Joe Shea, he was the Apollo spacecraft program office manager. That's what his position was and stuff. Okay, and basically he says that he said that Grissom was complaining about the Velcro, and then he says he says that Grissom put it in there himself. So you got a whole lot of dishonesty from both the contractor and the guys who were trying to put this thing into space, right? Oh, and here's another thing too. The door on the capsule.
Yeah.
Right. This was a new three-layer hatch, right, which opened inward and took about 90 seconds to open under good conditions, right? In the Mercury days, you had a little hatch, pull the lever, pops off. In the Gemini program, you had ejection seats. So basically, if you got an oxygen fire in there, no worries, you just pull the hatch and you blow the hatch and all the oxygen runs out, and so that, you know, all the sea level nitrogen stuff runs in and stuff, and so there you go, the fire is extinguished, you know. But because it's running on pure oxygen, so you pull the hatch, all the pure oxygen runs out, and there you go, no more fire. But Apollo, they had a three-layer hatch that opens inward, which under all that pressure would be impossible to get open inward, right? And here's the thing: the hatch could only be open from the outside. They could only open from the outside, and in an emergency, it was completely unusable. And a new hatch had just been designed, which could be opened within 20 seconds. All right, I believe Gordon Cooper, one of Grissom's buddies from the Mercury days, he said that would have saved Grissom. And here's the thing: the Apollo 1 plugs out test was to be the last time the old hatch was ever to be used before they refitted it. But here's the thing: it was also the first time they were going to use this hatch.
Weird.
Yeah, I know. So if they were going to replace the hatch with an easier one, why wouldn't they just postpone the test until they got the new one put on? You know, so they went out of their way to make the capsule as unsafe as possible. You know, and then what else was there? Okay, here's another thing too. Okay, there's conflictive as to when the fire actually initially began. You see, officially, only 15 seconds went by from the first mention of fire to the moment that the capsule ruptured. You see, as the capsule, as the oxygen burns and stuff, all this smoke and pollutants and stuff fills the air and increases the pressure to the point that the capsule bursts.
Yeah.
You know? And so, basically, it says that only 15 seconds went by, but other witnesses reported that the first mention of fire was minutes away. Like, Thomas Ronald Barron, one of the safety inspectors who was actually complaining as well, he was actually fired prior to the thing for releasing his findings to the press and stuff. And so after the fire, he testified saying that one of the guys, a fellow by the name of Al Holmberg, he stated that the first mention of fire was about 10 or 12 minutes before the capsule actually ruptured, and that they had tried to get out for 5 minutes, right? And now, Holmberg later denied what he told Barron, but another fellow, a guy, an RCA technician by the name of Gary Probst, he told a similar story. He said that it was at least 3 minutes or so from when the fire astronauts first cried out, and then when the capsule basically filled with flames, because he was watching the actual thing on the monitors. He was actually watching the thing, and there was a group of other people watching it with him, and he was like screaming, "Blow the hatch! Why don't they blow the hatch?" He didn't know that they didn't have an explosive hatch, you know, like they had on the Mercury days and stuff.
Right.
Basically, he was watching this thing, and they were having a discussion as to how long their suits would protect them from the fire, and like how, you know, could they get out or not? How long would it take to get the hatch open and stuff? And so, because like during this time, during the time of this conversation, right, the air inside it was still clear. And shortly after, then after that, about 2 or 3 minutes after that, the flames began to lick in front of a window. And here's the thing too: Paul P. Haney, one of the guys at NASA, he actually after the fire, he acknowledged that they had videotape of the disaster, you know, because like they had a camera there watching the watching the capsule burn, right? So they had videotape of the disaster, right? Now we are told there's no videotape. There's no videotape. Mark Gray, who actually sells, you know, stock footage, you know, the spacecraft films guy who used DMCA abuse, right? He has publicly said that there is no footage of the fire. No footage exists. Even though NASA, on the night of the fire, they actually confirmed that they had videotape of this stuff, right? Now we're told that no footage of the fire was recorded.
Weird.
Right? Well, we know that footage. Yeah, I know. We know that footage of the fire exists, and NASA and evidently spacecraft films are suppressing it. Okay, quite frankly, I wouldn't want to see the footage. You know, I don't want to see the astronauts die like so horribly. But that footage needs to be released because we need you know, proof. We need proof that, you know, just to how long these astronauts last. You know, we need to know, settle this thing once and for all, because we've got witnesses saying that they saw them trying to get out there for like 10 or 5 minutes or so, right? And now NASA is told that the first mention of fire to the moment the capsule rupture was only 15 seconds. No, I wouldn't want to. I don't want to say that. See the astronauts dying as much as the next guy, but that footage needs to be released to set the record straight.
Yeah, so we can study it and figure out what actually happened.
Exactly. We need to set this aside. Was it 15 minutes? Was it 10 minutes? Was it 5 minutes? Was it 15 seconds? Which was it? You know, we need to just set the record straight once and for all.
But they're saying that it doesn't even exist. So it's how you even.
They're saying it doesn't even exist.
Yeah. So you're almost. Yeah.
They're saying it doesn't exist.
There's no further you can really take that then, right? I mean, if they say it doesn't exist, and what are they going to one day just say, "Oh, we found it"? I mean, there's no. You're at like a dead end on that, I guess, right?
Yeah. No. It's we're trying to get NASA to acknowledge the truth is like talking to a brick wall.
Exactly.
You know? And
that's the Apollo 1
for you. Yeah, basically Grissom was complaining about Apollo, said it wasn't going to work, and NASA, they needed to silence him. He opened his mouth, he had to go. Recently, Gus Grissom's son Scott, he was actually granted access to the wreckage. You know, the cat steel is stored in Langley Research Center, I think it is. And he was actually granted access to the remains of the capsule, and he found evidence that a metal plate had actually been shoved behind the dashboard to deliberately trigger a spark when an astronaut pressed this button.
Wow. That's quite an allegation.
Yeah.
Well, what about the Challenger theory here? Now, what about this theory, conspiracy theory, that there was also, you know, an orchestrated disaster to maintain silence, if you will, and I'll let you flesh that out. But talk about that conspiracy theory, because I'd never heard that aspect of it all.
Okay, well, if you actually speak to any of the Apollo astronauts, or any astronaut for that matter, and ask them about the stars, okay, they would actually not comment in any way about stars. They would say, oh, well, you don't really see them on the nighttime side, or they'd be dim and fuzzy or whatever and stuff. Okay, it's like, because like in the beginning, Neil Armstrong, he comes back and he says, I couldn't see stars from the daylight side of the moon, and yet we've got other astronauts, we've got cosmonauts and going up onto the daylight side of the Earth and saying that we saw stars. The Earth is much brighter than the moon is on the daylight side, so you'd think you'd be able to see stars from the moon's surface. You know, and it seems like NASA has basically made this party line to their astronauts, do not ever talk about the stars.
Yeah.
You know, and Christy McAuliffe, the teacher who was chosen for the Teacher in Space project. Now, Christy McAuliffe, she was a very outspoken woman. She refused to be scripted by our government handlers. You know, she refused to be censored. She refused to basically tell bullshit to the class, because you know, like the education in America, it's pretty poor to say the least. But she wanted to tell it like it is. She wanted to make sure that everything was told accurately, so it's unlikely she would have said, you can't see stars whilst on the daylight side of the Earth, you know, and, okay, here's the thing about the Challenger, right? The Challenger was launched in cold weather, okay, I'm going to be measuring in metric, so, the temperature was about, on the launch conditions was -1 degree Celsius. -1 degree Celsius, which is about, let me do the calculation.
Well, it's certainly below freezing.
Yeah, so basically, I think, I know what that is in Fahrenheit, I use metric, but anyways, the launch conditions was -1 degree Celsius. Now, just the year before that, right, they had another mission in January 1985, which was Discovery's STS-51C mission. Okay, they all have their own mission numbers, like Challenger was STS-51L, this one was STS-51C, and there was Discovery launched in temperatures of only 10 degrees Celsius, which is also freezing, basically, what we have, the shuttle, if you can understand, right, you see the launch boosters, right, you see the external tank, you see the two right boosters on the other side, those are basically for lifting the weight of the fuel tank, because it's too heavy for the shuttle to carry. You know, on the launch pad and stuff. So basically, these boosters are what we use to carry the weight of that, and they're basically composed of all these different segments of solid fuel, which are bonded together with these thick rubber O-rings. Okay,
mm-hmm.
that's the bonded together with these seals and stuff. And so basically, these O-rings stop hot gases from leaking out. And if the gases leak out, that can cause damage. Like it can burn the external tank and basically blow it up. And so there was a fellow by the name of Roger Beaujolais who works for Morton Thiokol, which was the company that actually builds these boosters. I actually managed to interview Beaujolais a few months ago and stuff. Beaujolais, he actually took photos of the O-rings from that mission, from the STS-51C, and he noticed in this cold weather, the O-rings, the primary, there's actually two O-rings, there's a primary O-ring and a secondary O-ring. The primary O-ring had failed because of the cold weather, it had been frozen in the cold, and the secondary O-ring was less than a millimeter away from getting burned through completely. Okay, so he submitted a memo to his superiors basically saying that we need to stop launching in cold weather, otherwise we stand in jeopardy of losing a flight along with the crew and all the launch pad facilities.
Yeah.
Because he was afraid that this thing would blow up on the launch pad in that cold weather and stuff, because like, had the S-51C O-ring failed, okay, we would have had a shuttle blowing up as early as 1985, okay, but in 1986, just a year later, right, they were planning to launch this thing with the Teacher in Space project, and the launch coincided with even colder weather. It was the Discovery launch was 10 degrees Celsius. This one was minus 1 degree Celsius. And the night before the launch, right, Beaujolais and Thompson and a few other Morton Thiokol engineers, they got together with their management, and they basically, they telephoned Marshall Space Flight Center, the guys at NASA, who were basically, okay, they need to run some checks before the launch, and they need to know, okay, is everything functional before we launch this thing?
Right.
And, so basically, they called up and they said, we advise not launching in cold weather. This is away from goodness, as they say, because they didn't know how low a pressure could the O-rings could take. But obviously, the 10 degrees Celsius, that was a clear indication that was near disastrous. So, we're going to be even in even colder weather now. So that's sure enough to get your shuttle blown up.
Yeah.
You know. So we advise not launching. And the managers from Morton Thiokol said, first of all, we have George Hardy, one of the managers from Marshall. He said he was appalled by the decision, but he would only launch if the Thiokol managers said it was safe to launch, and at this stage Thiokol was saying it was unsafe to launch, but various other managers at Marshall were insisting that we launch. Like Lawrence Malloy, he actually said that the Thiokol's data was inconclusive, and that he actually challenged them to come up with proof. To come up with further proof before they say what is safe and what isn't safe. And so basically, all these guys at Marshall were pressuring the managers at Thiokol to basically change their minds and launch. And finally, the managers at Thiokol, they say, look, give us a moment, okay, we need to discuss this. And they go on hold. They wanted to go on hold for a minute, which ended up being about half an hour or so, I think. And so the managers, Gerald Mason, Joseph Kilminster and Robert Lund, okay. Robert Lund received the actual memo from Beaujolais, mind. Okay, the Beaujolais, the guy who said that we do not launch in cold weather. Here's the memo. It is the proof that it's dangerous, you know.
Yeah.
So these guys were equally aware, but you know, pressured by the higher ups at NASA, you know, they said, look, we need to take a vote on this. And eventually the guy said, you need to take off your engineering cap and put on your management cap. You know, and so when it looked like the managers were changing their mind, Beaujolais and Thompson actually got up and tried to get them to realize that this is a bad idea. You know, don't change your minds. Look, we have to make sure this thing is postponed. You know, we have to make sure it's in safe weather. You know, the managers looked like they were changing their minds, and Thompson got up, you know, showing charts and stuff, showing the calculations and stuff. But Beaujolais, he got up there screaming, showing them his photos from the damaged O-rings from the other mission. You know, basically screaming at them, look at this, you know, damn it, look at this. This O-ring is nearly burned away completely. Okay, what do you think is going to happen tomorrow if we launch in even colder weather?
Yeah.
But this time they were told to basically just sit down and shut up. You know, and all three managers agreed to vote to go to launch, and so they went off hold again and said to Marshall, it's a go to launch. to go to launch. And so it's basically, this was purely a management decision. All the engineers were basically told to sit down and shut up at this stage. And so obviously Marshall Space Flight Center immediately accepted their new decision to launch, you know, which was basically they pressured them into deciding. And so basically they reported that to NASA's top management and stuff. And here's the thing too, right? Another guy by the name of Al McDonald, who was one of the fire coal guys, okay, he was told that even though we don't agree on this decision and stuff, we will most certainly inform the top NASA management of your concerns. They didn't.
Right.
They didn't. Stanley Ramatas, right? He did not form Jesse Moore or Arnold Aldrich, who were the two top management guys that, oh, the dangers and stuff. These guys claim they weren't even aware of any hazard and stuff. And so the next day the O-rings froze up, and they launched the shuttle, and it blew up. It blew up, silenced all seven astronauts on board. Now, in the months that followed, right, Marshall and Firecall, they ultimately tried to keep lids on everything. And the guys who were actually speaking up, continuing to speak up, Beaujolais and Thompson and all that stuff, they were effectively demoted as punishment for their honesty.
It's very shady. It's very shady.
Now, I would like to point out that Beaujolais, he told me that he didn't think it was murdered, but he does feel that it wasn't an accident. He does feel, because like an accident is when you do something, is do a bad thing without prior knowledge of the consequences. He was screaming at these bastards, telling them that you launched in this weather, you're going to get the astronauts killed, and you got seven astronauts killed. You know, he took a really turn for the worse, because he became extremely, extremely depressed. You know, he felt he had failed the astronauts. You know, he tried to protect them.
Yeah.
Tried to save them. In fact, they didn't. The astronauts themselves, they were not even informed. You know, normally in the old days, you know, the astronauts would be informed of the shape of their spacecraft before they actually climb aboard. Here, they weren't even at the teleconference, which the arguments arisen. So, they probably had no idea of the danger that they were in, and they were effectively, it's like giving some guy the keys to a car that doesn't have any brakes.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's what it's like.
Yeah.
That's what it's like.
And so, essentially, you're saying that he thinks it was negligence, but you're saying that more likely, or we have to give credence to the idea that they were trying to silence, you know, Krista McAuliffe from potentially revealing the truth about what you can see from space.
Yeah, pretty much. The whole fact of the matter is that whichever way you look at it, whether it was negligence or whether it was murder, it clearly wasn't an accident. Because as Beaujolais said, an accident is when you do something that without prior knowledge of the consequences. Like if you accidentally exit out the door and actually densely walk into someone and stuff, that would be considered an accident. Or if you borrow someone's stereo and you end up breaking it by mistake, that would be an accident. When someone tells you that the shuttle is going to blow up if you launch in cold weather, and yet you still launch in cold weather, that's no accident.
Right, right. I guess at the end of the day, Jarrah, the question really, though, is I commend you, you know, for your passion and willing to go the distance here on proving one way or the other this moon hoax theory. But I wonder really, like, what's the point of it all? You know what I mean? Why? What difference does it make? We're not even going back to the moon anymore. And, you know, it's like saying that Abraham Lincoln plagiarized the Gettysburg Address. It's like what's the point, I guess? What's the motivating factor behind all this? Why do you think it's so important to prove that we didn't go to the moon?
Well, it's important to get the truth out, and whichever way you look at it, the mankind has nowadays become sort of dependent on space. You know, like we've got many, many satellites up in space now for everyday use. People can't take it for granted. And people have constantly talked about maybe visiting other planets in the future, you know, like setting up civilizations and stuff, but these are just going to be dreams. We're not going to be able to get anywhere, okay, with NASA constantly perpetuating this lie that that the Apollo astronauts went to the moon, but, oh, we're not going back because it's too expensive. You know, the real reason why we can't go back to the moon is because of the radiation, you know, and until we can sort out this, okay, we need to get NASA to acknowledge, okay, you faked it, now let's try to work out how we can actually go to the moon for real, you know, how we can actually reach the stars someday. We're not, as long as people keep living in this fantasy world that seven astronauts suddenly went there in this flimsily shielded spacecraft, you know, and with all this radiation, and yet now we come back and suddenly we're not doing it anymore. Mankind needs to move forward, you know, and we're not going to be moving forward so long as NASA keeps us living in this fantasy world.
Right. Okay. So that's sort of like the motivating factor behind all this for you, is to sort of set the record straight and get us back on track, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I as a kid, I dreamed of being the first man. You know who my hero was when I was a child? When I was a child, my hero was Andy Thomas, the first one of the Australian astronauts.
Okay. Yeah.
The Australian astronaut Andy Thomas, he flew the shuttle a few times. He flew the Mir space station and stuff. You know, and he, you know, I looked up to him. I wanted to follow in his. I wanted to be. He never went to the moon, obviously, but I wanted to be an astronaut too. You know, I dreamed of going to Mars someday, and then I realized that the truth is it's just bullshit what they're saying about how he went to the moon in the 1960s with very little technology and stuff.
Yeah.
Now they're constantly saying, oh, we can't go back to the moon because it's too expensive. It's not, nothing to do with budget. It's all about physically being able to survive the journey.
Right.
As long as they keep telling us it's garbage, you know, mankind is never going to move forward, and we're never going to reach the stars. It's important that we stop living in this science fiction fantasy world. Okay, get the facts straight. Okay, and then start putting on ones, working out how to actually get there for real.
Yeah.
That's what really motivates me. It's important to get the truth out so we can move mankind forward.
Let's say you're correct in this moon hoax theory and it eventually comes out. How do you see that unfolding? Because it would have to be, you know, at least another generation from now so that the people who perpetrated the hoax wouldn't be persecuted. Do you know what I mean? How do you see, let's put it this way, in a hypothetical situation, okay, the government is going to come forward with the truth about the moon hoax. How do you see that unfolding then?
Well, I imagine a lot of people will outright deny it. Other people will be, you know, have a big cry over it and stuff. Other people will just, you know, be able to get over it and stuff. You know, maybe they'll go, maybe they'll just be patriotic and say, oh, well, maybe they had to lie to us because we needed to beat the Soviets and stuff, you know, but some people just have to accept the fact. And once the world has accepted this fact that it's fake, okay, we need to, now we can try to focus on doing it for real. You know, we need to find out a way to shield the astronauts from the radiation, you know, because even on short-term mission, even a minor flare is a hazard to a human. You know, back in the 1960s, we were told that minor solar flares could deliver 25 rem per hour, depending on how much shielding you had.
Right.
And, but nowadays we're told, oh, only the major flares can hurt you. And then they say, oh, well, there's no major flares during Apollo, when there was major flares during Apollo. You actually look up the comprehensive flare index for major flares. This is NOAA's information, and you find that there were major flares during this time. And so you got all this garbage that's just out there to propagate this bullshit by NASA. And once we get this bullshit out in the open, okay, maybe now we can start working out how to actually do it for real.
Yeah.
You know? Because like as long as we're living in this bullshit world, you know, we're essentially gone back to the Stone Age in space terms.
That's true. That's the issue I have with NASA. As I said, I'm still, you know, I'm open-minded to the moon hoax theory idea, and I give it some credence, I guess you'd say, that I do find something very suspicious about the whole lunar missions, but I'm not on board necessarily with the outright idea of a hoax. And hopefully that does not, you know, hopefully that doesn't not sit well with you. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I respect and appreciate the research that you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if I can look through the telescope, the VLT, and see if there's a lunar module up there, then I'll say, hey, I was wrong. Okay, congratulations, guys, you made it there. But if it turns out, you know, there's nothing up there and stuff, then that's the proof, and maybe then we can finally move mankind forward.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, that's the hope that we can get this. I you know, no matter how it happens, I'd like to see the space program get back on its feet in a big way. But you're saying that it's limited by the natural problems of space flight that they refuse to acknowledge.
Yeah, and it's not just that too. Because of the Apollo program, we're getting so many wrong ideas about the moon and about space. Like the Apollo samples that NASA returned to, supposedly returned from the moon, turned out to be, you know, almost identical to terrestrial basalts. You know, it had the same chemistry, same mineralogy, same oxygen isotope ratios.
Yeah.
If it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck's a duck. You know, and now the Smart One probe crashed into the moon, finds out that the actual stuff that's up there is different. And that's effectively being swept under the rug. No one's ever, it was announced in the news, and then it was just shunned out of the spotlight completely. And God, I was taping the program when they first announced this stuff, eh? And so that's the whole issue. We're getting so much wrong information about space and about the moon because of NASA's bullshit. And when we need to, effectively, once we get this hoax exposed, officially exposed, we'll effectively have to relearn everything we now know about the moon stuff because of all this nonsense that NASA has put out.
That just makes you wonder if it'll ever come out. What about the idea that private space travel is going to unlock this mystery or solve this debate in a way where someone will die trying to go out to space, not you necessarily on this mission, but, you know, they'll run into the problems with the radiation belts, and then that'll open the door to the revelations that you're talking about.
Well, hopefully private space adventures will contribute towards the exposé of the thing. If I recall correctly, they've got the private organization Space Adventures. Of course, they're working with the Russian space program on this thing, which is one of NASA's partners and stuff. But of course, if we can, you know, if anyone dies on the lunar tourism thing, okay, then we'll know for sure that this thing is fake. And then, of course, there's the other fellow, Richard Branson, the guy from Virgin Airlines and stuff. He's started up the group Virgin Galactic. He's I believe he said on the telly a while back that his ultimate goal is to put out a motel resort on the moon. Good luck with that.
Yeah, you're saying that's not even possible.
It's not even possible, you know. If radiation is going to be such an issue during a simple moonwalk, you know, when NASA supposedly returns to the moon, if you're going to have to be, you know, pit barked inside a cave for most of the time you're up there, okay, then how are you going to build a motel resort on the moon? How are you going to build this base there? Because obviously, you know, you're going to be having astronauts trying to build this thing, constantly bombarded by radiation, okay, and so it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So, unfortunately, people may very well die, you know, in the process. Maybe some people might actually build a rocket, you know, maybe and go to the moon thinking that they can get there because NASA said they can get there, and they end up dying in the process. You know, it's people are going to have to learn the hard way, unfortunately, it seems.
That is the case if what you're saying is true. It's going to end up ugly, that's for sure.
I know. So essentially, I feel obligated to put my life on the line, you know, because like I'm, as the grandson, you know, I feel heavily involved in this thing, and I feel like if anyone should die just to prove that the radiation was deadly, you know, it should be me. It should be me who goes up there, I think. You know, I'm not afraid to die for the sake of the truth. I always wanted to be an astronaut as a kid, and so, you know, if astronauts of all generations, they put their life on the line. Any mission could be deadly and stuff, and well, I feel that it is my duty to put my life on the line to for the sake of the truth.
All right. Well, I think that is commendable that you're, you know, willing to put your life on the line here for this theory, and I'm sure, you know, you'll take some flack from people, especially the moon landing proponents, you know, that are so ardent about this. But, you know, I commend you, you know, for your passion about this subject. I think that, you know, regardless of where I fall in the debate, I respect, you know, the lengths you're willing to go to, you know, raise awareness of this issue and this debate. Now, what else is, you know, pertinent to this whole conversation? I'm sure, you know, you've put out 400-plus videos. So, I mean, I ask you this question with trepidation because I know we could go another, you know, hour and a half here talking more about the moon hoax and all the implications of it. But what sort of stuff may have fallen through the cracks here that we should make sure we cover here on this, you know, your initial appearance on the program?
As I told you before, I recently managed to meet up with Adam Savage and Phil Plait at that convention. I also managed to meet up with Buzz Aldrin.
Mm-hmm.
Buzz Aldrin, you know, the supposed second man on the moon and stuff. It was like, as we were talking about the moon rocks earlier and stuff, recently, this was one of the subjects I had planned on meaning to delve into during the 40th anniversary was the fact that shortly afterwards, right, one of the moon rocks that was on display in the Dutch museum, which was a gift to former Dutch Prime Minister Willem Drees, okay, it turned out to be a piece of petrified wood. And this was given out to the guy during the Apollo 11 astronauts' goodwill tour. See, they toured the world and stuff. They were during their time in Amsterdam. They were accompanied by the American ambassador. Now, from what I understand, they gave this moon rock to the ambassador, who presented it to the former Dutch prime minister. And so the ambassador he was commented on these lines, and he said, "I didn't know that this thing was." He was very interested in the rock, but I didn't know it was fake. That's news to me.
Yeah.
And so basically Aldrin, he was appearing in Sydney this last October, right? And basically he was at the Australian Geographic Awards night. And basically, I purchased tickets to that, and I contacted the organizers to ask if it was possible to arrange an interview with him, because I had a few questions I wanted to ask him. You know, one of them was obviously the Dutch moon rock thing.
Right.
And basically, they told me it wasn't possible to schedule individual interviews and stuff, but they invited me to his press conference. He was giving an actual press conference during the just the night before the day before the actual ceremony.
Yeah.
And so, like, I went there with two cameras. Like, I was sitting in the front row and stuff. And I asked him the question. I asked when you're in possession of this supposed moon rock, were you aware that this was petrified wood, or were you also, you know, led to believe that this was a genuine moon rock? You know, and he was like, petrified wood. Oh, that doesn't sound like that came from the moon. And then he started saying, okay, maybe they must have switched the moon sample and stuff. So he seemed very uncomfortable answering that question and stuff. It certainly took him by. So he certainly wasn't expecting someone to ask him that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very strange.
So after that, yeah, I know. And so I had a few questions I wanted to ask him, but I only was able to ask him one. And the very next day, the Sydney Morning Herald, they jumped on that and alleged that I was some antagonistic gay crush who had to be removed by security. It's in the article title. Yeah, I know. It was in the newspapers. Security, we have a problem.
Oh, my God.
I complained. I know. They just turned it into a media frenzy. That's the... It brings us back to the whole issue of the propagandists and stuff, because, like, if a conspiracy theorist talks to an Apollo astronaut or one of their fellow propagandists and stuff, okay, it's always, oh, he stalked him, he ambushed him and stuff. But if anyone else speaks to them, okay, they're the good guys. You know, like, when I went up with Plate and Savage at Cam 8, they alleged that I was a stalker, that I had stalked them to there, I ambushed them and stuff. Well, I paid $175 to gain entry into that venue, okay, and Plate and Savage were very open about their appearance there. I had as much right to be there as did anyone else who paid to get in, and being a documentary filmmaker, that makes me eligible to be granted interview with the speakers.
Right.
I did not ambush anyone. I did not stalk anyone, you know, and same case with Buzz Aldrin. Now, I was invited to this thing.
Well, do you think then that maybe, just to get really meta on this, that, you know, I joked earlier that he was the wacky uncle of moon hoax theory, but do you think maybe that's sort of like the Bart Sabrellification of moon hoax theory? I mean, in a lot of ways, I think he might have hurt the theory. I think he might have hurt the research community of you guys who are advancing moon hoax theory, because it became such like a national joke that he was punched by Buzz Aldrin for asking if they went to the moon, you know, and now you're being painted sort of like he was. They're sort of insinuating you acted, you know, in a way that he behaved.
Yeah, well, I didn't act any way where he behaved. You know, I was very civil and stuff. You can see the video on YouTube. It's Jared White meets Buzz Aldrin and stuff. I was very, very polite. I didn't insinuate anything against him. You know, I was just, okay, giving him the benefit of the doubt. You know, Mr. Aldrin, this rock turned out to be fake. You know, can you please tell me what your side of the story? Were you aware this was fake, or were you also were you also led to believe this was a genuine moon rock? You know, I was just giving him the benefit of the doubt, you know, and so he answered it, and then the media turns it into a frenzy. They actually compared me to Bart Sabrell. In fact, they said that my actions were like similar to that. It's all in the Sydney Morning Herald.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean,
I complained bitterly about that. I and only after I showed them the my invitation, they published my email below the article. You know, and some people have suggested I sue the bastards.
Yeah, well, you know? Then you could fund your trip to the moon.
Yeah, that's an idea. There's an idea. Yeah. Anyway, so far I've raised about $329, okay, and I still need to raise $200 million. But if any believers in the moon landing are listening out there, if anyone wants to put the money where their mouth is, you know, they've constantly said I wouldn't be convinced if I was flown there and shown the artifacts. Well, if anyone wants to put their money where their mouth is, feel free to send a donation. The PayPal address is flyjarrettothemoon@gmail.com. Okay, you just send in any money. It doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to be small. It can be any price that you want. Okay, it all adds up. And I'll be sure to acknowledge that you sent the price. I can keep your email sent. I can keep your identity censored if you prefer. You know, if you want to remain anonymous, that's fine. Anonymous donor, that's all right. And I'll be sure to post a video and saying, okay, you sent me this money. The price is the total amount is now this.
Yeah.
And so I've made it. Yeah. So I'll be continuing to fund this thing. You know, until I either raise the money or I'm deemed unfit too old for space travel, I guess. I believe there's an age limit. And at the rate they keep shipping the supposed return date back into the future, I'll be a bloody granddad before they actually set a proper date or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's a good segue here to sort of the wrap up question. You know, between now and when you're deemed unfit to be sent to the moon, what do you have planned? You know, for the rest of this year, for the next few years, for the immediate future. You know, you said you sort of started this out with one long essay that was practically a book. Have you thought about, you know, as the grandson of Moon Hoax Theory, putting out that third generation book to act as the capper to Kasing and Renee? You know, a third book, if you will, for this Moon Hoax lineage, genealogy, the latest on the Moon Hoax Theory. What do you have cooking? Potential book, maybe putting this all together into a full-length documentary. What can we look forward to in the future from Jero White?
Well, as I said before, the essay itself needed a bit of editing. Like, I needed to strip down a few of the less than pleasant things I had to say about my opponents, you know, because, like, you know, back then you tend to get pretty angry at times every now and then, but, you know, I managed to develop a sort of tolerance. Anyone will say I'm very polite in my videos, and so I tend to keep the same style in my films. So, but project-wise, I've got a eight or so hour documentary series coming up. It's called Moonfaker, Moon Rocks Revisited, which is basically a look at various new material regarding Apollo samples and moon rocks and stuff that has, you know, surfaced since they originally put together Moonfaker Exhibit D, which discussed moon rocks and the alleged laser reflectors and stuff like that. And basically a lot has come up since then. You know, there's been some criticisms made, and there's been a whole lot of new material popping up out of the woodwork, you know, like, and there's also some stuff that I missed completely that I felt I should have worked into there. And so basically this 8 hour thing, which I've been working on for the past year now, it's nearly finished. I've only got about two films left to complete. Okay. I had to chop it up into each individual episode. So each episode is like maybe an hour or half an hour or so long and stuff. So this film series as a total is about 8 hours or so in length. It covers everything. And so, that should hopefully be out in April next month. In fact, by the time this radio show is on the internet, it might already be up there by then.
Probably,
and,
yeah.
I've also got a new website coming up, moonfaker.com, which will basically have a frequently asked questions page, a site where people can view all my videos, and various places where people can actually, you know, contact me, you know, like ask a question or send in donations for my fundraise or request an interview like you're doing right now, obviously. So yeah, hopefully that should be out around the same time as the Moon Rocks Revisited series. And I've got many more projects on the way, but that's the big one that I've been working on for the past year or so. I started around April last year, I think it was. And I've just been working on it since. You know, like I've been accumulating all the um, all the stuff that had happened, you know, since the release of my first Moon Rocks series, and now, you know, all the stuff that I missed, all the stuff that came up, you know, like the Dutch Moon Rocks thing, the L Cross Impact, and many other things that has happened, and so I've managed to all work in there, and I'll also be challenging the various criticisms that some propagandists have made in response to my original video on moon samples, and so yeah, that should all be out in April.
Awesome. Well, folks should definitely look out for that, and if they want more from you, they can go to youtube.com/whitejera, and you spell the whole thing obviously youtube.com then slash the word white, WhiteJarrah, or go to moonmovie.com, and hopefully moonfaker.com will be up and running soon. And, of course, links can be found all over Banal of America, so you'll be able to get your hands on this information from Jera White.
I also recommend the Bill Casing tribute site and, of course, Ralph Renee's site, you know, to get their message out. You know, you can go to ralphrenee.com. You know, to get Renee's book, and you can go to the Bill Casing tribute site, which is billcasing.com, which is a site in honor of the grandfather.
There you go. All right, yeah, so be sure to check out those sites as well. And, yeah, well, I got to thank you here, Jera, for coming on the show. I know you're like 15, 16 hours ahead of me there, so I actually woke you up by accident because I was confused about the time difference. So I really appreciate you taking some time out of your Sunday morning to appear on the program here. Fascinating discussion on this moon hoax theory. As I said, you know, I'm sort of on the fence about this. I don't totally discount what you guys are saying, and I think that there was definitely something very fishy going on. So I find your work to be pretty fascinating, and, you know, I watched the debate with quite a rapt expression, you know, enjoying the battle that goes on here between you guys and the propagandists. And you know, whether you agree or disagree with Jera's point of view on the moon hoax, you got to give him credit for, you know, being a warrior here in the world of esoterica and really putting in the hard work, putting in the travel miles, and really willing to go above and beyond, and as he said, right up to the precipice of doom, if not death, to prove that the moon landing was hoaxed. So, you know, kudos to you, Jera. I wish you the best of luck. Hopefully this isn't the last time we talk. And keep me posted and keep the listeners here posted on, you know, the latest developments here in your research into the moon hoax theory.
No worries. It was a pleasure being on here, and I hope to be on the show again if you want me back. And thanks a lot. Thanks. It's been wonderful. It's been a time and a half.
That does it for this installment of BOA Audio Season 6. Big, big thanks to Jera White for coming on the show. Check out his websites, moonmovie.com, moonfaker.com, and youtube.com/whitejera, and you spell that WhiteJarrah. And now, before we say goodbye to Jera White, he wrote to me, having heard the interview before we aired it, and want to just clarify one mistake that he made. He says that in the interview, he said that Bill Casing learned of Thomas Ronald Barron before his chat with John Grant, but actually it was vice versa, although Casing was very aware of the Apollo 1 fire prior to his discussion with Grant. So there you go, that applies to the part we were talking about, the Apollo fire. So a little clarification there from Jera White. Doesn't want to get those propagandists in a tizzy over a slip of the tongue. Totally understood. Moving right along now, we're going to skip BOA Audio listener feedback because, first of all, it's been like 3 weeks since we produced an episode, and a lot of people are talking and are outraged or confused by what's going on. So I want to address all that and sort of clear things up so people know what's going on with the program. It's ironic. It's been a just tumultuous season here, season 6, trying to get these shows out to you. All these different technical problems almost since the very beginning of the season, definitely since the start of the year. It's been just crazy, starting with us having to drop all of the theme music from previous episodes, and then a whole bunch of other stuff, culminating, of course, in the double episode we put out on April 25th. I'm an idiot, really, is one big way to put it, because I thought it was going to be great that we put out two episodes in one day, and I just did not account for the huge amount of bandwidth that was going to take, and it blew out our servers in Canada, the folks who were hosting the show for us. And they'd had enough. They threw up their hands. They said, BOA Audio is
out of here, man. And they shut down the whole archive of programs. So if you're trying to listen to the show right now, well, if you're trying to listen to the show here in 2011, May of 2011, I should just go back and edit this out sometime in the future when everything's all straightened out. But nonetheless, if you're listening to the program here in May of 2011 and you can't hear it streaming audio-wise and you can't get the show via iTunes and you can't download the full show MP3s from the site, that's because our hosts up there in Canada pulled the whole shebang down. That happened literally the day we put out the double episode. So we had to scramble and find out what we were going to do. And luckily, we have struck up a deal here with our new audio host slash distributor. I think I'm just going to call them our audio distributor here going forward, because that's really what they're going to be doing for us in a huge way. Of course, I'm talking about CyberEars.com. They're the folks who have helped us out in a big way. Big props to the folks at Paratopia who suggested I get in touch with the guys at CyberEars. So where was I? Let me get back on track here with this story. So we reached out to CyberEars, came to an understanding, and we are bringing the program over to CyberEars. They're going to be hosting the BOA Audio MP3s, and they are going to be doing the streaming audio for us as well, which is huge. From a technical standpoint, folks, up until this past couple of weeks and this big imbroglio, we had been really running the whole operation on 2005, 2006 technology here. The stuff that I learned when I first created the program. And along the way, little bugs seemed to be piling up over the years that we just could not get around to fixing. By moving the whole show over to CyberEars, it's going to be so much smoother. They're going to take care of the whole iTunes feed. They're going to have a whole bunch of additional stuff that I just never could even come up with, stuff that will tie into like the iPhone and the Android and stuff like that that there's no way I'd be able to do. And they're going to be reliable because they are geared towards hosting and distributing podcasts. So that's the perfect place for BOA Audio and a much better operation than what I've been doing the last 5 years, which is running the whole distribution wing of BOA Audio myself. Quite frankly, the technology is beyond me at this point, and I need to bring in some professionals who know something about distributing podcasts. So that's what we're doing here with the CyberEars folks. They are outstanding, and I couldn't be happier to be working with them. And it takes a huge stress off of my plate because it's going to just clear a lot of work for me in the long run. So it's a good sign for BOA Audio. It's a great turn of events. I know things have been crazy here this season. We're going to get it all back on track. Don't worry. We're in the midst of switching the entire BOA Audio archive over to CyberEars. Once that's done, all the links and everything else is going to be fixed at Banal of America. It's quite a project. We had to take out, obviously, all the theme music that we'd used in the past and replace it with the songs that have been contributed by the BOA Audio listeners. So you'll be hearing that kind of stuff, too, when the archive gets freshly posted. And I'd say we're at about 3/4 of the way done with that. I think we just have to get seasons 4 and 5 taken care of, and then all the past episodes here from season 6 thrown up there. But we're in good shape as far as that goes, but it's quite the project. I'd like to say that BOA Audio is going to continue unabated here over the next few weeks, and I'm pretty sure it will. We got a great episode lined up for you next week. It may not be next week, maybe 2 weeks from now, but that's how the program rolls, folks. That's how it's going to have to keep going, because that's what BOA Audio has evolved into. And so to wrap it all up, BOA Audio Archive took a huge hit from our previous hosts. We found new hosts. We're moving it over there. That's why things have been crazy for us the last few weeks. It's ironic because right before that happened, it seemed like everything was going on full cylinders. We were back and up and running in a big way. And then boom, just got nailed with a huge, huge pain in the ass. But something that in the long run is going to be enormously beneficial to the program. I could keep rambling about this. If you have any other questions, feel free to shoot me a line, boaaudio@hotmail.com, or go to binallofamerica.com, binallofamerica.com, and click the contact button. Or just find me on Facebook or Twitter, or join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com, or go to Banal of America and click the forum button. Don't worry about the program. I've gotten a lot of emails from people who were very confused by what was going on here, because just you couldn't get any of our old shows all of a sudden and were really wondering and worried about us. Don't worry. Everything's fine. you know, people are freaking out too much. Everything's cool. It's been crazy, but that's what happens when you reach the level that Banal of America has. It is just small problems are enormous problems. That's really the best way to put it. That's how it ends up here on the show and at BOA. Speaking of which, why don't we do the thanks part of the show now? Allow me to give my just unending thanks and appreciation to the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, our contributing cartoonist, Andy Carolan, and our webmaster, Jeremy Boston. There, I got them all in that time. You guys are the best. Thank you for sticking with BOA during this rough stretch. We've got a ton of columns from these guys that I've been dying to put up and get posted at BOA. So come on over to the website. You're hearing me right now, so you know I'm telling the truth. There's tons of cool stuff at Banal of America right now. We say it all the time, and it is the truth, my friends. If you're only listening to BOA audio and you're not reading the columns at Banal of America, then you're only getting half of the story. BOA, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. Normally, this is the part of the program where we have to turn to you folks out there and ask to make a donation to BOA and BOA Audio. But as we have been plugging on the last few installments of the program, we are helping to produce a film with Red Star Films titled Beyond Best Evidence, The UFO Enigma. It's going to feature a whole bunch of really awesome names in the world of ufology, giving us their perspectives on what it all means, what this UFO phenomenon is at the end of the day. And we are crowdsourcing the funding for this project, so we want you guys to help us out and help us to make it happen, if you can, of course. You can go to indiegogo.com/UFO. Once again, Indiegogo, IndieGogo.com/UFO. For more information and find out about our donor system, each different level of donation comes with a whole bunch of different cool stuff. So you're not just getting the thanks and a pat on the back, you're actually getting access to interesting aspects of the production or just cool bonus benefits. So check out Indiegogo.com/UFO for more information on Beyond Best Evidence, The UFO Enigma. Now let's talk a little bit about who we have lined up for you on the next edition of BOA Audio. We're going to be looking at the film that is really generating a lot of buzz in the world of esoterica right now, talking about Eyes of the Mothman, and we've got Matthew Pawlowski and Anastasia Constantino on the program to talk about it. This thing was really the brainchild of Matthew Pawlowski. He's the director and creator of the film, and Anastasia was one of the staff and crew behind the whole project. She may have even been a producer. I don't have the information right in front of me. But nonetheless, Matthew was sort of the diehard Mothman enthusiast, and Anastasia was sort of someone who hadn't heard of the story before and really got knee-deep into the mess when they made Eyes of the Mothman. Now, I feel kind of bad saying this, but I should point out Eyes of the Mothman is streaming on Netflix right now, so anybody out there with Netflix can actually watch this film in anticipation or follow-up to our interview here with Matthew Pawlowski and Anastasia Constantino. I may not say that on the episode next week because I don't want to really hurt these guys. I don't know how you get paid if your show is already on Netflix. But since we're talking to the hardcore BOA Audio listeners and you've been waiting so long for another edition of BOA, I figured I'd give you a little heads up that for those folks with Netflix streaming, you can check out Eyes of the Mothman right now. We're going to be talking about the Mothman phenomenon. We're going to be talking about the film. A lot of weird stuff happened in the making of Eyes of the Mothman. You're going to hear about that stuff. Really wild, wild stuff. Tune in next time on BOA Audio. Matthew Pawlowski, Anastasia Constantino, the makers of Eyes of the Mothman. And on that note, let's close the book on another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Big, big thanks once again to Jera White for coming on the show. No folks to thank for listener feedback. We'll bring it back next time around, I promise. And the only folks left to thank, of course, are you guys out there listening right now. The hardcore BOA Audio listeners, the ones who stick around to the very end when my voice is dying and I don't have anything else to say. Thank you guys for your support. I love making this program. I'm not going anywhere anytime soon. Don't stress out. Things are just going to get bigger and better from here. Thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.